Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. Now, you should know how this goes by now. I'm surrounded by people I know and love in life. At the moment, I've just got people that I know in the room. To my right, it's Owen Cutts.
Hi.
To my left, it's Kevin McPherson.
Yalla.
Why did you decide to go ethnic?
Why not?
Just took it to the other end.
Why not?
And the Talk Stew special guest today is none other than Reg Free 2.
Shabba.
Can we talk about what's on the table? Because Kev, as it's quite cold, decided to moisturise before we began with this Aesop.
Oh, that's yours, bomb. Kev?
Yeah.
I thought that was yours, Reg.
No, it smells good. It smells too good for
it
me.
It proper looks like a Reggie thing, though.
It does,
doesn't
it?
What does that
it
mean?
What is a Reggie? It looks like you got one in your bathroom, one in your car.
Yeah.
Can we unpack this a little? What's a Reggie thing, Reg?
A Reggie thing? Reggie's the suave man, isn't it? Like, Reggie,
right, that's right.
Reggie knows about... I can only imagine what
look
you shower with.
Look at the way he's creaming his hands.
Isn't it? Clockwise, anti-clockwise.
Fingertips.
Can I use some of this though?
No, it's a Reggie thing.
This is I would definitely define this as sexy cream though.
Yeah, it is sexy cream.
Like, I know this costs £200. I know.
Listen, Rich, I'm so glad that you made it to the stew, man. There is so much to talk about with you. See the difference between the way I moisturize and Rich? Yeah, what does that say about our characters?
This means I'm excited to use the cream. I'm trying to get my £200 worth in one rub.
To be fair, I think you just used about £10 worth of the point in your palm, but I'm not one to judge. Okay, look, Rich, there is so much to get into. You've got a new record out.
Yeah.
I've known you for a long time and the progression's incredible. Your connections to Kevin and Owen are fantastic, but we'll get into all of that in a little bit. First and foremost, I really wanted to share with everyone in the room, really, what I've been doing today, because today has been another day in the office, as it were, making a film that I'm really excited about. So I'm working on a documentary at the moment about Grenfell and the Grenfell Tower.
Sick.
And I've known about this film for quite some time. I've been shooting the film for quite some time as well. It's for BBC Two. It's going to be an hour long, and I'm really excited about when it finally does come out. But the difficult thing is I wasn't allowed to talk about it publicly until the press release came out. So yesterday, BBC press office put it up on their Twitter. I screenshotted it, put it on my Insta, put it out there as well. And off the back of that, I have had one of, if not possibly the biggest responses I've ever had to anything I've ever put on social media ever, on my Instagram particularly. It was like nearly 700 comments or something like that. Now, the reason I bring this up is not to talk about just how popping my page is.
Mr. Popular. Yeah.
But I feel a certain level of pressure for the first time when it comes to a documentary.
Yeah.
And this particular film is important. You know, I'm a Londoner. I grew up in an estate myself, but every third, second comment was the same thing. And that was, you are the perfect person to make this film.
Yeah.
We can't wait to see what you're going to do with this, Reg. And by the time I saw that 300 times, I was looking at my phone like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to ask you about pressure. You've got a new record out and you're held to a certain esteem. But you think about that. We'll get back to pressure in a minute. Yeah. I kind of want to talk a little bit about Grenfell first, because, you know, it's something that is nearly 6 months ago now. And if you're from this city, I'm sure you feel a certain connection to what happened. And if you're from West London, like, oh, you might have even got involved.
Yeah, I got involved. Yeah, definitely. You can see it from my window. So I saw it burning. And when we woke up the next morning and it was still burning and it was smouldering, we just had to go down. Like, kind of crazy, just put anything in a box, you know, like, I don't know what you need, like clothes and a toaster and just packed bags and boxes, stuff we don't need / take for granted. And we just got in the car and drove, and I was driving down St. Mark's, if you know the area, and you can't see it because there's a petrol station, and then you get to this road and then it was just there. And it was just like, there's people just standing by it, like, just jaw dropping.
Yeah.
But there was mum's there, kids there, dad's there, old women there, bags. Like, the community spirit was insane. I couldn't kind of grasp the kind of, like, severity of it because it was just that morning. But
what was the biggest surprise in terms of who you saw giving that day?
Like, there was, like, goons in cars, you know, pulling up and taking out bags, and grannies in cars, you know. It was just like anyone asking, where can I take this, where can I drop this, what can I do, what can we do, staying around, you know.
Yeah.
On the flip side also, which was I found really harrowing, was people on the phone saying, I haven't got hold of Gary, or I can't find Mohammed, or have you spoken to Selena? Do you know what I mean? That was like, oh my God. And then the following few days on Portobello Road, there was just posters, man.
Yeah,
like missing posters. Right, posters.
Yeah. What was the sort of feeling? Because you're both from the same part of London. You're from North, and I like to think of it as a London issue and something that hit the city. But, you know, particularly in West London, you really felt it.
Yeah.
And your side of the city, what did you hear? What did you see? What was being said?
Do you know what? I just remember switching on the news and seeing the building on fire. And then I'm thinking to myself, I'm standing there thinking, what the hell's going on?
Hmm.
And you know, like automatically, like your brain does this thing where it's like it tries to put you back into a scenario of something where you resemble that situation. And the closest thing I could think to what I was witnessing was when I saw the Twin Towers.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a big building, there's fire, it's manic, there's chaos. And then you're watching it, and then you're speaking, different people are ringing you.
Mm.
So it's like you're on the phone, you're speaking to yourself, you're speaking to someone on the phone,
you're
looking
media.
On your Insta,
yeah.
You're looking at so much different things, you're getting different angles, different perspectives. But the worst thing is, 1 hour goes by, it's still on fire. 2 hours go by, it's still on fire.
Mm.
And you know when it gets to that point where you're like, this actually ain't going to stop today.
Mm. No. Mm.
This is going to burn continuously. And then you start trying to put yourself in people's shoes who must be in that building. Bro, have you walked past your oven when it's open?
Yeah.
Walk past your oven when it's open. Put your hand like close to your spotlight. Try and imagine what the hell they were going through like at that time. Like that heat is mental. Forget the smoke. The heat alone.
And we're talking about what, 24 floors?
Bro, 20 floor of heat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We won't ever in our lifetime imagine what that was like.
No.
We won't even get close to imagining what that was like being in that building that day. And they're all the thoughts that I was just thinking at the time. And then obviously you wake up the next day and it's still going.
Yeah. I think everybody was surprised at how long it took for it to be dealt with and what was going on. Kev, it sounds to me as if you felt the same way. You thought Twin Towers first.
Yeah, it was surreal. Because as you said, when you sort of go back to the Twin Towers, I remember exactly where I was when the Twin Towers happened. And it was almost like, as you say, you kind of recalibrate your brain because it's like you're looking at this building. And you're, obviously, it's not as big, but in that moment, you're not even thinking that. You're just thinking, there's families in there, there's babies in there, there's kids in there, and there's people who, you know, obviously frantic.
Mm.
It's like I might not necessarily have had known someone there personally, but as you said, like you sort of think, what must be going through people's minds? Like,
do you know, the thing that I've taken from being in the area a lot in making the film is the attitude that we as London have towards it versus the attitude of the people on the ground. And as someone who felt that I would know what it would mean to be a person from that community, was sort of quashed quite quickly after being there for a little while. So I'll explain what I mean. I was adamant that the building should stay up. I was adamant that it was a sign of neglect. And it would be a fantastic reminder to everybody what happens when there is a disparity of wealth in a city like London.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you get there, they'll say that building to us as local people is a coffin. It's an open casket. There are remains of hundreds of people there and that building needs to come down and it needs to come down ASAP. And the weirdest thing about being there is that you've got this black husk of a building at the minute and all you see occasionally is what the people I've been speaking to are referring to as ghosts in the building. And those ghosts are the forensic men and women doing investigation. Mm. And of course, they're head to toe in white.
Mm.
So when you look at the building, sometimes you just see these white figures.
Yeah, that's mad.
Walking. It's the most surreal, the most strange and the most unbelievable place to be right now, I found. And, you know, walking on the silent march and walking through Notting Hill, which we all associate with noise and carnival and people, millions of people at that. But to be walking through the high street and for it to be silent.
Yeah.
And the power of silence I've never experienced in the way that I experienced in making this film. Look, it's a real somber way to start the show, but it's something that's on my mind and it's something that I'm literally was dealing with today. And, you know, that pressure of delivering something to people that really want something of a certain quality it just, I don't know, it's just really chimed with me, particularly in the last 48 hours. And I can't front, you know, I look at you in a certain light. Mm-hmm. And whenever I think about you as an artist, there is a level of expectation that comes with you, that comes with your name. That pressure, it's a very different kind of pressure. I'm by no means comparing what people who've been through this tragedy have experienced to
I'm
talking about me and feeling for the first time in my career a pressure associated with something I'm going to deliver. Do you feel that every time you know you're putting together a project?
Do you know what? I do. But I'm probably like my biggest fan and my best critic, because when I'm thinking about creating a record, I'm an extent thinker. Like, I think the best gift I've been given in life is my thoughts. And I also think it's my worst nightmare at times.
Right.
Because I'm a severe thinker. So when I think about album, I think about the title. When I think about the title, I do word association. I think about what the words associate. Mm. Would it be looked at negative? Is it positive? Does it reflect? What mood should it have? What texture should it be? What colours should it represent?
What's the most time you spent on a record? Or even more on a verse?
On a verse, when I'm writing my fire in the booths, I tend to take a minute on them. That's just because my writing process is like this. I'm in the studio, I create the instrumental with the producer, and I write on the spot, so I don't write anything down. So I'm just walking around the room, I'm writing it. I get the whole song, or I get a verse, go and lay down the verse.
You've never written anything down?
I have in the beginning, but this is my new technique. So the problem with the fire in the booths is, it's like I'm not just recording it on the day.
Mm.
So it's like it might be like on the 21st of July and it's like the 15th of July. So I've got time. So I'll do like 20 bars today, come back, go over it tomorrow. Just walking around my house. And that's why the fire in the booths take longer, because it's not like I'm writing it, then recording it there and then. But anything else is just recorded on the day.
And that pressure that you associate with the fire in the booth, is that because you came out the gate so strong? And now you have to top it or match it by a minimum?
That's because, like, when I wake up, I believe I'm the best writer, I'm the best rapper. So I think the pressure of feeling like you are, I don't know, the fastest man in the world means when you hear on your marks, get set, go, there should be nobody in front of you. Do you get what I mean? So that's just the type of mentality I have when I wake up and when I'm creating. I'm just like, there shouldn't be anybody that can top this, doing this.
Hmm.
So I just always just make sure it's above and beyond, really.
Who's close to you? Because, you know, we have that debate all the time about who the best MCs in the UK are. And let's face it, it's the same 4 or 5 names that come up. When it comes to lyricism, I can only really think of 2 or 3 names. So who's the best?
I'll say, like, Getz on his day can't be played with. I say Kano on his day can't be played with. I say Chip on his day can't be played with. Like, there's some people that, on their day, they're messy. But the difference is who can be messy every game. That's why Messi is messy. So I feel I'm the best, yeah.
Mm.
I feel like the day that I wake up and I feel like I'm doing a song and this guy's taught me and I go back for him again and he's taught me again, I'm like, boy.
Have you always felt like that? Have you always felt, since you started rhyming, I'm the best?
Nah.
Or is it?
You kind of need to find your strength, and I hadn't found it yet. And it's just over practice. And then I became obsessive.
Right.
And I think that's the difference. Like, literally, when they talk about that 10,000 hour theory, like, it's the difference, bro.
Yeah.
Like, it's who's going to go studio, write a song there, go home, write a song there, write a song when they wake up. Who's going to constantly do it?
Yeah.
And that was me. And then, that's what kind of separated me and pushed me further.
I think that, and this is the thing, to ask the question, who's the best, it's kind of a dead end. It's a bit of a red herring, because when you're talking about being messy, it's consistency. But the thing is, consistency inevitably is won by people who put in the most work.
Right.
The best example I can think of, so on the Jamaican sprint team, you had Usain Bolt, and then there was, what was the other guy?
The Beast.
Johan
the
Blake.
Beast. Right, yeah. Johan Blake is 5'8".
How tall's?
6'5", right? Now, understand this. For every one stride that Usain Bolt would make, it would be 1.5 strides for Johan Blake.
Mm.
But Johan Blake has beaten Usain Bolt on occasion at 5'8". He's not really tall enough to be sprinting that those kind of speeds.
Mm.
But who puts it in? Now, I'm not saying Usain doesn't put it in, but don't get it twisted, because he's defined the laws of physics as we knew up until that point. But for a 5'8" guy who's got, what, nearly 10 inches down.
Yeah, that's crazy.
There you go.
Why do you think this question about the best MC keeps coming up? It's the thing that we always talk about here, specifically in the UK anyway. I mean, people have done it since time immemorial in the US. Is it the nature of the beast? Is it because of the competitive nature of the business?
Yeah, it's the sport.
Right.
It's the sport, man. It's the sport. But it's always going to be subjective, isn't it? It's always going to be an opinion as to what your preference is. Because to one person, Getz is the best and I'm nowhere near him. And to somebody else, Giggs is the best and me and Getz are nowhere near him. Do you get what I'm saying? It just depends what your preference is and what you like. But in terms of what I like, I'm the best at doing that.
What space are you in now as an artist? Because you look like a completely different person to the person who released Tractor.
That's all that surgery. And the 60 cream.
When I think about Wretch Tractor era,
yeah,
you were like one level, low crop. You were, you know, I mean, you looked different. You appeared different. You felt different. What's changed?
I think I'm maturing. I think I've matured a lot as a person and as an artist. And now I understand what I need to be doing and how I need to be doing it. At that time, you're kind of just thrown into the ocean. And it's like, just get in the ocean, get to the other side. And you're like, rah, I ain't really ever had swimming lessons. But I know I can't drown here because I'm capable of doggy paddling at least. So then you kind of just find your way. But then now, like, you throw me in the ocean, I'll know that maybe I can just stand still and wait for a boat to come. Or, do you know what I mean? I'm more wise. I understand how to get to the other side now. And I think that comes with trial and error, comes with age, comes with patience. Probably patience the most.
Because, well, and also growth. Like,
yeah, growth.
Like, how much do you attribute to that journey from Be Cool to going to number one with Don't Go? Like, that 2.5-3 year stretch, like, who you were in that time must have changed dramatically.
It's mad.
Because I imagine the change from Don't Go to now isn't massive, but the change from
From that to that, yeah.
Like, one of the first videos that really got play, that really put you out there, to actually getting a number one record, that must have been dramatic and over, there's not a long period of time.
Yeah. It's mad, like, literally, because I always believe that on every CD, there's a few different songs that I try to make. Like, I try to make the club banger, I try to make the wedding song.
And the wedding song. What's the wedding song?
The wedding song is the Don't Goes. The wedding song is the Six Words. On the latest record, the wedding song is Happy.
Define the wedding song.
You see, okay, so I think, like, music is mad deep. And I say that because there's songs that define defining moments in life. And I say that if you watch X Factor and then you'll see they've got the last 50 contestants. 25 of them are going through and 25 are coming out. But there's always a song that they play that sums up that moment.
Yeah.
So if you notice, it's the same song. They don't change the song for Room B. They keep the same song. And it's normally like something like Take That Greatest Day. And it's like, gling, 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 today this could be. And it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds. And then it gets to the point where this is a no, but it still makes sense because he's saying today this could be the greatest day of our lives. But then when it gets to the yes now, it's like, stay close to me. And that song there defines that moment. And I think the wedding song is the song that defines that first dance, that love for the person. It's just, it's more of a feeling than the lyrics sometimes.
So amazing.
Yeah, like, you have to, like,
so amazing to be loved. Why are you looking at me like that? My singing is beautiful.
He doesn't know the song.
No, I'm looking at him because he's singing.
What's your first dance song?
My first dance song, it'd probably be Eric Benet.
Smooth Spend My Life With You.
No, this is a classic. That is like the black winning.
Which one? Which one?
Spend My Life With You. And
how's that go?
To me. I'm not going to sing it.
What was your first dance song?
Mine was Brian McKnight, Let Me Show You How Your Pussy Works.
You're serious, isn't it?
No. I didn't have one.
Can you imagine?
You what?
So the funny thing about it is, I've met his mother-in-law, and I
can only imagine her face.
Let me show you how your pussy works.
Wait, why didn't you have one? What, conscious decision?
Yeah, my wife didn't want one, man. She doesn't
really?
Like, yeah, she doesn't like attention being on her, and she didn't want it. She finds it cringy, and she was 7 months pregnant, and she didn't want one.
Weird. Did you play a song walking up the aisle?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was In My Life by the Beatles was the song out while walking, she was walking up the aisle.
Yeah, that would have been your first.
But she got nervous and ran up the aisle, so it was like it's like the first 8 bars of the song.
But she was there. It was
done. Yeah, it was there.
Come on, let's get going. Like, what baby was the problem?
I've paid these guitarists, right? Like, keep playing, boys.
What would your first dance song be, Rich? On your wedding day? It wouldn't be your own.
It should be my own. But
really?
Why not?
Should be.
Nah, I couldn't do that.
No. There's no shame in that.
Really?
No shame.
Should be.
I don't see why not.
But why not, man?
That's like saying if you was a caterer, if you had the time, you probably wouldn't cater at your own wedding, but you could cater for your own wedding.
No, but there's something about it being someone else's words and someone else. I don't know. I don't know. So you would be one of yours?
It wouldn't be one of mine, but it could be, but it wouldn't. But I would pick, I'd probably have Stevie Wonder. Isn't She Lovely? I love that song, man.
Big tune.
I love that song, man.
That completely takes... Maybe I'm a massive narcissist. I'm like, but what about me, though? What about me?
Yeah, isn't she lovely?
Yeah. Can you see this suit? Do you know how much I pay for this suit?
What would you have?
What would I... I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
Would it be a song about you?
Probably.
Would it be one of yours?
This song is about you. You're so vain. Come, babe, just dance, babe. Just dance, babes. It would probably be something like that. I don't know. Now, Owen and Rich, you guys go way back. You're connected by a really important guy for the three of us, actually.
Massive.
He's someone who I actually recently wrote about in the book that I put out, because he was incredibly important in me stepping away from music, mm-hmm. which I made a lot of with Kevin, and focusing on my TV career. The guy I'm talking about is Richard Antry, and he is actually, well, you used his name for the intro of your last album, mm-hmm. right? And I introduced Richard to you to manage you.
Yeah.
So what can you, I mean, it's interesting because so many people love that song on your album.
Yeah.
And you've got a really long and strong relationship with him, as do I. And at his funeral, which I wasn't at because I was filming abroad, everybody in the city came out, it feels like, to show their respects. So for anybody that's listening that's a fan of Wretch, you probably have heard that song and heard Wretch's version of who Antry was. And I'm pronouncing it like a real Ghanaian. You might call it Antwi, but it's Antry. Who was Richard to you?
Richard was my first manager when I was an artist. And you introduced me to him with Twin.
Over a Thai meal.
Over a Thai meal, Portobello Road.
Portobello, yeah.
Yeah. And I've never, ever had this in my life where he looked into me. Like, he looked, when I remember when Richard first looked at me, I was like, how you doing, I'm Owen? I'd heard a lot about him. Mm. He'd just switched from a lawyer to management, and he'd just got Natty a deal at Atlantic.
Natty, that's a name I don't
know. That's how far, that's how long ago it was.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he just looked inside me. It's almost like his eyes went in and had a little look around. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, has he got it? Has he, you know, does he? And then we just had the most amazing friendship just started from there. We used to send each other soul records and talk about old music and strategize and plot. You know, Wretch, you know what he's like. And and through that, I met Wretch. That was just before Tractor, everything. Mm-hmm. We did that
sessions
tiny
and everything.
Sessions.
Yeah.
What did you think when you first met O?
When I first met Owen, do you know what? I'm one of them people, I just love banter, like love jokes. And like me and Owen were just literally just messing around, like just running joke. And I thought, you know what? I like this guy, man. Like I just like his aura. I like what he creates. And it's just kind of just been a little organic music friendship.
Yeah.
And then it adds a little family element because it's come through Richard and we're all kind of under the umbrella as well. Yeah. So it was just, it was a good time.
So why was Richard's name fitting for the intro to the last record?
Do you know what? I used to send Richard records.
I think everyone did.
I did too. Like countless amount of songs. And then he either comes back with some email that's 38 paragraphs or he comes back with, you're a beast. Yeah. So Antwi wasn't called Antwi, but it was the intro to the album and I sent it to him. Now, I've sent him the song and this time he's come back with a paragraph and it's just like, man, you're a beast, man. Like, you've got to go America. like, this is really, you know, you got to go and do it. Stop holding them back. Like, go fly out there, try and do it, bruv. Like, you can rap with anyone in the world. And, like, it was like a proper touching email. This is the last song I sent to Richard. That's the last conversation we had. So, for me, I was just like, raw. And I'm talking like, if I send it on the Monday, he passed away like 2 weeks later or even less than that. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, for me, I'm just like, raw. This is the last thing we've spoken about is this song. And I'm like, what do I do? Do I go in and change the song and make it about him? Do I knew I needed to, I just felt I needed to do something and I just didn't know what. And I was like, nah, don't go in there and change it because it's not, it's about what it's about. And when it's time to write about Richard, you're going to write about Richard. But what can we do? I'm saying this is the intro to the album. Call it Antwi, man.
You know, funny you should say that. The last message I got from him was him telling me he's proud of me and that he was proud of my documentaries. I've just finished watching some. I'm sat here just staring at my screen. The TV's off Reg. Like, I'm proud of you. And it's like, it's the last time I heard from Rich. It's mad.
That's crazy. But I mean, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing 100%.
Yeah.
Like, if it wasn't for him.
Yeah, yeah. How much have your personal relationships affected your projects and your music and the work that you produce, Kev?
When you say personal relationships...
Well, family, friends, love, girlfriends, whatever.
That's a weird one. I find... Because I'm not an artist, and so I think... I feel like with someone like Rich, it's like he's the definition of what I class as an artist.
Because he's got like, dreadlocks.
That's the appearance. But I think it's because... You couldn't do anything other than what you do.
Yeah.
Like, literally, if someone said to you,
agreed.
What are you going to do? What's the plan B? I don't know. So it's one of those things where I think you have the ideas guys who create from, you know, have a spark in it and they coax it into a flame. And then you've got, like, the craftsman type. So the craftsmen are generally producers. Some producers are vibes guys, but generally they're the craftsman type. They're the geeky, nerdy guys that execute and finish. So for me, my relationships, interpersonal, personal, romantic or otherwise, generally don't affect my output. There's been a few times I've done things that have been inspired off of situations I've been in, but that's relatively rare for me.
That one foursome.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear someone say that though.
Go on.
Because like, it's weird, isn't it? Because like, I'm like the complete opposite.
Yeah.
If you've ever told me to fuck off in life, it's coming. Like, it's coming. Every single feeling I've felt from a person, it's coming. Yeah, there's a line or a paragraph, depending on how much it affected me. And it might not come today. You might say in 2010, it might come in 2020.
But it's coming.
How do you feel with that though? Because there are some things that aren't for public consumption. There's some things you don't share. You know, I'm sure you were raised in a similar home, which is some things stay in the house.
Yeah.
Don't take this outside the family.
But I think as an artist, that's the whole point, is you do wear your heart on your sleeve and you are vulnerable to some extent.
Or you disguise it. You're talking about one thing, but you're actually talking about something else.
But my point is, as an artist, as a true artist, I would say, it's almost a given that it's like you are, here I am. And for warts and all, flaws and all, they're the most endearing people.
Well, by that logic, is anything off limits for you then, Rich?
Do you know when I realised that there's probably nothing off limits? When I made a record, the record I made with Ed Sheeran, it's called Hush Little Baby, and it's about my son, but I'm actually speaking about an abortion. So it's like after making that song and understanding that this boy is going to grow up to hear this song and think, right, at one point, you might have questioned me even. I don't think there's anything that can be worse than that. So I feel like if I can do that, I can almost do everything. And it's not like I'm not going to say your name. You know what I mean? I'm not going to say your address. I'm not going to say who you are. But it has to come out through something.
Have you ever regretted putting something down on a beat and had a reaction that has made you think maybe I shouldn't have done that? Should have camouflaged that a bit better.
Nah.
Fuck you, Tina.
Because I think everyone around me understands that that's the space I create from. And I've spoke about everything. I've spoke about mum throwing me out at 16. And it's funny because I speak about it in two different ways. I speak about it in a way where I'm angry about it. And then there's other times where I'm in a lyric where I'm like, you want to be a man, then a woman has to mold you. And it's like, that was the best way. That's the best thing she could have done. And that was when I had accepted that that was the best thing to do. So sometimes it's about reflecting and even getting over the feeling that you felt at the time.
How often do you think about how much you're speaking for other people? Because you said something in a song that I felt like I wrote. You said something about an ex and it was along the lines of, don't look at me, don't look at me. What's the bar? What's the bar?
Ex, don't look at me, don't look at me, unless you got the whole booking fee.
I don't know how many times I rewound that.
I just want to say at this juncture that Reggie at one point wanted to be a rapper. So I think he actually literally
not wanted. He was.
I heard you. Where did you hear me?
I swear I've heard you on like MySpace or something.
Oh, wow. Do you know what though? That tune you did with Hudson was good.
Why are you still? Hang on a second. Why are we so surprised that it was good?
No, I'm not surprised. The Hudson bit was good.
Oh, Ben, if you're listening, we love you, Ben. We love you, Ben.
Hey, Hudson, my guy, you know.
That's so funny. Well, Ben did that thing, didn't he, of being an artist that the entire industry was talking about. And it's really interesting that you bring up Ben Hudson, Mr. Hudson and the library to everybody else, because if you're involved in the music business, I mean, Richard did his deal.
Like, Richard was his lawyer.
Yeah, it's all very incestuous. But, you know, if you're involved in the music business, you'll occasionally hear about certain acts that everybody's talking about, that everybody wants to sign. And for a long time, they were people that were on the complete other end of the spectrum to the music that you make.
Yeah.
And that was around the time that you got signed. You got signed when there wasn't really Black British music in the charts in the way that it is now. How have you felt about that change when you see people going crazy trying to sign Steph London for 1.2 million?
Yeah, for mad money.
And it happens, you know? This was an MC that would have been ignored. This is an MC that would have been on Channel U 10 years ago.
It makes me happy, man, because I feel like we proved our value. I think before, because effectively the record label, they're a profitable organization, company, whatever you want to call it. So they, ultimately, they want to make a profit. They want to spend a pound and make a fiver. Mm. Regardless of the material, they want to spend a pound and make a fiver. Who can we spend a pound on that's going to make us a fiver?
Do you resent coming up in the era that you did versus what's happening now? Because there is an argument to say that they've got it easier now.
Yeah, they do. And they're supposed to. That's because we fought for it. We fought to prove. I remember like going to festivals, my band setting up, and the bands that had been doing festivals for years looking like, oh, look at these guys, let's see what they're going to do. Bro, we had to fuck, like, I had to show you that I can do an hour with a band. I'm a rock star, not you. Like, I'm a rock star now. We're supposed to be here. And it was like, every room I walked in, like whether I went to the Mercury's, I felt like that. Whether I went to the Brit Awards, I felt like that. And it's like, you have this sense of, I'm supposed to be here as well. You get what I'm saying? And then I think once it becomes the norm, then it's like, okay, cool, Stormzy. Then now this is what Stormzy's got to do. You've got to surpass everything I've done. Do you know what I mean? Because the new Stormzy under Stormzy has to surpass everything Stormzy does. Mm. We're supposed to get bigger. We're supposed to have a rapper in Wembley Stadium. And I want to see that in my lifetime. And to know that I'm being a part of the steps, it's a sick feeling, even if it's not me.
I will say this. One thing I'll say with this industry, and it's luckily in my lifetime I've seen the change, but there's always been artists that have been signed who unfortunately never fulfilled a promise. And the thing with labels is, and unfortunately one of the things about being Black, maybe back in the day, was if someone had put all their eggs in one basket on a particular artist, and that artist, for whatever reason, didn't work out, it would be years. Right, for years. So there was a signing back in the day, Polydor, a rapper, who was the biggest signing. He signed for 1.3 million.
Can we say his name?
Yeah, you can say his name.
JP.
Right, yeah. So Jean-Paul Esquire was a rapper that he did a lot of remixes in the late 90s. He was featured in a lot of remixes.
And with Ignorance, right?
Yeah, with Ignorance. And he was the one. Like, when I say they threw the kitchen sink at this guy, and he never delivered an album. And it took until So Solid, where everyone went, oh, Black music can work. Well, Black MCs can work. But then they messed up, as we know, for various reasons. And then it came to you guys. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing about progression is every subsequent generation that's come has learnt from the mistakes of the previous.
So
when you're saying about Stormzy outstripping you, it's not even a thing of you necessarily saying, it's not an ego thing. It needs to happen.
It needs to happen.
It's evolution. Yeah, yeah. It needs to happen. And I just think, from my perspective, watching you succeed or Stormzy or anyone else, it's like, yes. Mm. Because I remember around the turn of the century, it wasn't easy.
Well, they say it happens in 5-year cycles, right? And that's the one thing that someone who spent 10 years at Radio 1, I worry about, you know, because you have 5 years where it's, oh, we're only playing guitar bands. And then you have 5 years, it's like, that's, oh, we're all about EDM.
That's changed now.
And it's like 5 years where it's like, oh, black music's got their moment in the light. I think, I agree with Kev, I think it's shifted now. Now, the power is in the people's hands, not in the radio station's hands.
Because that's your own radio station.
It's changing everything.
Well, from the perspective of a producer, how do you circumvent the bullshit that comes with the hot artist that everyone's got to work with?
Well, if they are the hot artist that everyone wants to work with and you get to work with them and they spark something off in you, then fair enough. But if they come and just sit in the room and they don't do anything, then they're just like anyone else. Mm-hmm. You can't get a record from just everyone. Like, special artists, you know when they're special.
Yep. Mm. It's
hot or not.
Hot or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one's heard them. I always get it when I get jealous. Seriously.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah,
when I'm like, fuck, I kind of want to be this kid. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's sick. Do you know what I mean? Like, how can you write that? Do you know what I mean? That's when I know.
Yeah.
This kid's, or this artist is special.
When was the last time you were jealous of another rapper's verse?
Nah.
It's the correct answer.
No, because you know, I was thinking and I was... And then I said, you know, like you have that quick conversation with yourself, like, nah, it must be one. No,
like, not even Foundation, not even like a Nas or a Jay or someone like that.
Now, there's one verse where, like, Jay's going mad. He's freestyling on, I think it's Funk Flex. And he's talking about the same sword they knight you, they're going to good knight you with.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
only half if they like you. That ain't even a half what they might do. That verse there, for me, I was just like, that's when I started talking about this
suicide.
Thing called Gear
it's
6.
A suicide. Suicide.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's the verse. Yeah. That's when I started talking about Gear 6 and I was like, nah, there's another gear. I was saying, like, we've only been hitting Gear 5, but there's a Gear 6. And for me, it was just like, you better that verse. And I spent, every time I was going to do a freestyle, I remember I went on Westwood after hearing that. Like, I'm going to top that freestyle every time. So it's just competitive. But I didn't feel like, damn, I just felt like, all right, better me kind of thing.
You know what's interesting about that verse in particular and talking about American MCs through the context of British Eyes is your name was mentioned on a podcast that I listened to, and that was during a conversation about Skepta. So there was a conversation about Skepta happening on the Joe Budden podcast, right? And it did make me laugh because one of the guys on the show went, I got to the Skepta track on the Drake album and I was feeling a little skeptical. I'm like, these guys.
You know what I mean? He's got a punchline.
he'd been sitting on it for a while.
Yeah.
But it was funny in the moment, and I was just frustrated because of the way that Skepta has been referred to by American fans of Drake. So what's your relationship now with American audiences in the States are aware of you and what you do?
You see, one thing with me is like, I'm a very understanding person. So I get why someone won't get something. It's like the first time you hear an MC or a rapper from Manchester or Newcastle, like you're so used to a London accent. When you hear Bugsy Malone or you hear someone from Newcastle, it's like, I don't know, like it takes a second to kind of kick in, and we're living in the same country. So I can understand, but then it gets to a point where you have to let go of your ignorance. Just because the MC's from Newcastle or Australia or Manchester, it's the talent, not the accent. And I think they're holding on to a bit of ignorance at times.
What's the attitude now? Do UK MCs even care?
We don't even care. That's the whole thing. But that's what makes it better. Because that's why now, like, someone like Joe Budden will hear a verse from me and be like, that kid's just sick. Because it's not like I'm tweeting him my song. It's different when back in the day we might tweet them us like, yeah, yeah, check this out, bro, or have a listen to this when you got a time. Nah, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm as good as you. You get what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's like, when you hear me, you're supposed to say that. And when I hear you, I'm supposed to say that. And I think that's the common ground and where we're at today.
I think to build on what you just said in terms of the holding on to ignorance, it's not even just that. I think for a lot of people who, and there is a division now between the old heads, the Joe Buttons of this world, and the newer generation, but I think that there's a certain thing where the moment you're British, the fact that you are black is not relevant. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you go to America and you open your mouth and they look at you the same and they look at him. Like, even the way police will treat you...
For the people listening, Kevin's pointing at the white guy. Kevin is pointing at the white man.
The Caucasian man, to my right.
Sorry, you can carry on.
So it's almost a thing where it's like you're working from this thing where you have to prove you're not Hugh Grant. Because they'll...
Do you understand what I mean when I say that?
Like,
You're not real. You're not
seeing
crumpets.
Exactly, because you're not, and that's the term as well.
Tea and crumpets.
Well, yeah, I gotta ask you, man, because you are one of those MCs who, from where I sit, and it could be a place of naivety, it doesn't feel like you've done the big American trip.
I haven't.
Why?
I want to.
But I mean, just the idea of you being in a room and Jay-Z going, "Yeah, there's gotta be a part of you going on Funk Flex and smashing that freestyle." Like,
yeah, that can happen. I'm gonna go and do that. I'm gonna go and do that. But the actual, I'm in America for 6 months,
strategically trying to crack every state. And then has their own station,
doing promo, doing tours.
Do you know what I mean? And then coming back 3 years later to a 9-year-old, I've been selfish enough. Do you know what I mean? Even though this is my dream and my goal, innit? I'd love to be worldwide, but it's like, I feel like in this day and age, it can happen from here.
That there is priorities. To me, is the way forward.
Like, yeah, and I feel like I've missed enough, man.
Has your career suffered by not doing that trip? Because it might have happened for you in a way it hasn't happened for some of these other guys.
Yeah, and if it happens like that, it really happens. That's the thing. But I can't look at it like that, man. I'm fortunate. I actually feel like in my beginning years, I was a pauper, fam. That's how I feel. Like, I feel like I was a have-not. And I feel like now my luxury is a full fridge and a roof. And now I've got a roof and a full fridge. I can't complain about anything else. So I can't look at it from that perspective. I just have to concentrate on getting better, delivering excellence as often as I can, and forward thinking.
Respect that.
Yeah. So how much does that approval of your heroes matter?
As in, like, the Jay-Z's?
Yeah.
Bro, that's a god to me, man. Like, oh, I'd love to ever do a tune or hear something, but it's like...
Because he spoke about Kano.
Yeah. I remember. Was it on Semtex, isn't it?
I remember. I was listening. Was that kid Kano?
Yeah, exactly. And he didn't know the name, innit? Yeah. At first, he's taking a look. He's like, "There's that kid." Nah. And my man said the name. He was like, "Nah, not him. Yeah. It was someone else.
You were that guy.
It was me. It was like Rich. He was like, "Nah, not him. Not him, son.
Not that guy.
Young. But yeah, that's things in life that we can't plan for that, man. Like,
I mean, it bun you a little bit when he said Kano, innit?
Nah.
I'm just shit staring.
It would have only bun me if the person was crap.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Because then I'm like, man, you didn't even hear the real thing.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
But Kano's the real thing. Yeah. So it's cool.
All right, so how have you felt about Skepta being almost a flag waver for UK music and around the world? I mean, he's big in Australia, he's big everywhere now.
The thing is with Skepta.
And gigs for that matter as well.
Yeah, gigs.
You know, they're both on that Drake album.
Bro, they're people that, they stick to their guns, man. Like, they stick to their guns. Like, gigs has stuck to his guns the whole way. Skepta, he has tried bits and bobs, but he stuck to his guns ultimately. And for me, what's cold about the Skepta thing is coming from Heat FM, when Skepta was the DJ. Do you get what I'm saying? In a different crew, Terrorist Squad, I think it was called. Yeah. Skepta was the DJ, bro. We're on the same pirate radio station. You were the DJ. Then he started spitting. Don't lie. Heard his first lyrics. Well, he's not even that good, but he's all right. He gets better. Bam. He's gone. He's Skepta now. You know what I mean? And it's, for me, it's even sicker to see, because I remember watching you mix records. So now to see you, even them little things, like when they're on stage at the Brits and Kanye's like, "Skepta!" Like, that's cold for me, because that's my guy from years ago. You know what I mean? And then gigs. Bruv, gigs has been grafting. You sit down with that guy and ask him how much mixtapes he's got, he won't even be able to count.
Yeah, for real.
He was dropping a couple mixtapes a year, like for years in a row. So to get his moment, I wanted to see that for myself. Bruv, he's just a guy that just, he loves his music and he sticks at it, and it's well deserved, man.
So what feeling do you get then when you see someone like a Drake do what you've just described, but for Skepta or for gigs?
Bro, it's nice, bruv. And there's like, you know, like people, I always get people that will say to me like, "Yeah, man, but he ain't shouting you out though." I'm like, bro, no, he doesn't have to, fam. You know what I mean? He doesn't owe me nothing. Don't, like, him shouting at my brethren is the same feeling I would get for him shouting me out. We're all like one thing, bro. Like, we're brothers. So that's how I feel about that, man. I'm happy for them, man.
Yeah. This is the last thing I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask both as a fan and also as someone who's just interested in what you think. Now, you spoke about that next generation and someone coming along and going further than you have. Who's the next Reg?
The next Reg is Avelino. Definitely. Genius.
I've got the No Bullshit mixtape album.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It's a genius.
It's ridiculous.
He's a and he's playing. He's playing on that. He's playing. He's playing. The kid, when Mr. Miyagi saw Daniel-san, he knew. He needed to bring him close and say, wax on, wax off. That's exactly what I've done. I've said, come here. Like, imagine Pele spotting Messi doing kick-ups in the park. He's going to see it and he's going to say, you, come with me. Whatever you need, I'm going to give. Yeah. Like, I don't even want to manage you. I don't want to profit from you. I just want to see you be who you're supposed to be. That kid would be the best rapper in the world when I'm finished.
That was like an ending of a movie, man.
Dude, I'm just really annoyed that I don't have a bomb to drop. Like, I wish I could
make one.
Listen, on that bombshell, I think we should close it out. Rich, I really appreciate you coming through to the stew, man.
Pleasure.
Owen Cutts, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Kevin McPherson, thank you so much for the hand cream.
Thank you, Kevin.
I've just noticed it costs £19.
£20 cream, bro.
I'm serious about my moisturisation. That's what I'm telling you.
Say the name and you might get some free shit, man.
I'll say, yeah. Because seriously, this could be quite big.
Bro,
so
put it out there,
this could
bro.
Be a big Kevin, this could be your
bro,
thing.
Put yourself out there, man.
Right, so Kevin, do the advert. Do it properly. Go on.
Do the voice. Do the voice.
Buy Aesop Resurrection Aromatique Hand Balm and you too can enjoy the shiny black skin enjoyed by many generations.
Say goodbye to Ash. Say hello to Aesop. Aesop. Available now.
I want 20%.
I do too.
All right, we'll see you next time for Talk Stew.
Kill me. Come on, bro. Help me out.
Hang on. For the record, we stopped recording and we started recording again.
I'm not putting my headphones on.
Owen is in a rush to leave. Owen, where are you going?
I'm going to the cinema.
Who are you going to the cinema with?
My wife.
And why is it important that you get there?
Huh?
Yes, man.
No, I'm not doing this, Reg, man.
Why is it important that you go to the cinema with your wife?
Kevin.
Is it because you love your wife?
Yeah, it's because I love my life.
Anything else?
You love your life.
I love my life.
No, that's Freud. A Freud slip. Freud slip. He loves his life.
Because I love my life.
Are you scared for your life?
No, no, it's cool. So because I can go out tomorrow night.
So how does that work then? So she's in charge.
Don't, Rich, honestly, don't put this in the show. I'm serious. I'm not even putting my headphones on. I'm not playing.
Don't dig in a hole. He's smiling, but he looks only in the mouth.
I've gone red.
Not eyes. Just
enough. I've gone red. Rich, don't put it in the show. Don't fuck with me, man.
That's how we're going to end the show. Yeah. See you next time for Talk Stew. Brought to you by Owen's Embarrassment and Aesop.
Don't fucking put that in the show.
Yes, you won't listen all the way to the end.
Put it in!
Put it in! See if she fucking listens to everything I do.
Put that on the mic. See if she listens to anything I fucking ever do.
5/7 production. Now, don't forget, you can hear more bonus content from The Stew on Deezer.com.
Deezer. Originals.